Blog Talk Radio.
Maybe I see you working hard, wanna let you know and proud, let you know that I admire what you do. Don't know if I need to reassure you, if my life will be purposeless without you. If I want it, when I ask you, you inspire me to be better, you challenge me for the better. Sit back and let me pour out my love letter. Let me help you, take off your shoes, untie your shoestrings, take off your cufflinks. Don't you wanna eat food? Let me feed you. Let me run your bath water, whatever you desire. I'll cry ya, sing you a song, turn the game on. I'll brush your hair, help you put your durag on. Wanna put a rug, want a manicure. Baby, I'm yours, I wanna cater to you, boy. Let me cater to you, so baby, this is your day.
Making sure that I'm doing my part. Boy, is there something you need me to do? If you want it, there's a word. I know whatever I'm not fulfilling, another woman is willing. I'm gonna fulfill you, my body and spirit. I promise ya, I keep myself up, remain the same shit you fell in love with. I keep it tight, I keep my figure right. I'll keep my hair fixed, keep rocking the hottest outfit. When you come home, they tap me on my shoulder, I'll roll over. Baby, I heard you, I'm here to serve you. Love you need, give it, it's my joy. All I wanna do is cater to you, boy.
Let me cater to you, cause baby, this is your day. Do anything for my man, baby, you throw me away. I've got the slippers, your dinner, your dessert, and so much more.
Destiny's Child, cater to you, for all of you that's in love. Anyway, I had to start off that way because, y'all, it is, by all accounts, Valentine's Day. So hopefully if you don't have love this year, maybe this time next year. Anyway, good evening, everyone, and welcome to another Friday night's edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. We're in the month of February, which is Black History Month. And so we would be remiss for Black History Month to come and go without ever mentioning the black female giants of the civil rights movement. So that's what we're going to be looking at tonight, African American women have played a key role in American civil rights movement. Without their struggle for freedom, for racial abuse, it would not have been possible for Americans to achieve racial justice. African-American women like Rosa Parks, Joanne Gibson Robinson, and Ella Baker were just a few who led the front. Although women played a significant role in the civil rights movement, they were not given the necessary attention they deserved. Their names are lost in the pages of history. People all over the United States celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, but little do they know that Martin Luther King, without support, hard work, and help from African-American women, particularly Rosa Parks and Ella Baker and Joanne Gibson Robinson, would not have achieved as much as he did. In fact, it was Rosa Parks' act of defiance that ignited the national civil rights movement. So tonight, we don't want to repeat history by only talking about the male giants of the civil rights movement for Black History Month. We would like to take tonight and highlight Black female giants in the movement. These are women who worked as hard as any man to achieve racial equality for people of color. So let's get started. AJ and Christopher, good evening. Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah, good evening. How you doing? Happy Valentine's Day to you, too.
Christopher, are you with us?
Yes, happy Valentine's Day as well to you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, listen, y'all, I know everybody's got a sugar booger tonight, so we gonna jump right in talking about Black history. And I'm looking forward to tonight talking about the Black female giants of Black history, because that's something that's rarely done. You know, you hear about all the males that played significant roles, but rarely do you hear about the females. Would y'all agree with that?
Yeah, I agree.
You agree? Christopher, yeah. You agree?
Yeah, and I also agree with something Dick Gregory said. He said the two of the greatest things that have ever happened on the in the history of this planet is the Black woman and the Black church. So I definitely agree with the backdrop to Black women creating the atmosphere that allowed the civil rights and just the struggles in general. I don't think they would have happened in the way that they did or had been as successful if it was not for the Black woman.
Oh, I love that. I agree. Tonight we're going to talk about, you know, Black women like Harriet Tubman, Fannie Lou Hamer, Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, Mahalia Jackson, Nikki Giovanni, Susan B. Linda Horn, Mary Curry, and what was the other one? Mary McLeod? Am I pronouncing it right, Bethune? Am I pronouncing that right? I think I am. Okay. So those are some of the ones we're going to talk about tonight. Y'all are awfully quiet.
You're talking.
But we can't talk about civil rights, y'all, until we talk about freedom. And we know that Harriet Tubman was one of the ones that showed a whole lot of Black folks how to get to freedom. So, Christopher, you had an affection for Harriet Tubman. What did you find out about her?
Well, Harriet Tubman, and she's one of I'm a little biased. I mean, and researching her and looking at some of the monumental things, there was just loads and volumes of information because she was such a go-getter. In the military, we say all over it. She was doing so many things across the board that she's most famously known for the Underground Railroad, but she was a spy for the Union Army. She was a soldier. She was a nurse. She did a lot of things that actually turned the tides during the Civil War. And just finding out a lot of things about her, that she had more tentacles than I think a lot of people realize.
You know, I found her to be quite interesting, too. I found out that, what was it, at a young age she was hitting the head with a weight, I think like a 2-pound weight or something, and that caused her to have all these these visions that she said were God sent visions. And I'm looking for my notes on that, which I found very, I think what it was is she was in a store, from what I understand. She was in a store, and a black man was in there, and he'd run away. And the person that was chasing him, who was Caucasian, and I'm looking for my notes, y'all, they wanted Harriet Tubman to help apprehend the man. And she was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And the guy took a weight, and he threw it and hit her in the head. And after that, she started having all of these visions that she said were God sent. And so, anyway, I'm assuming that that helped to give her some of the wisdom that she used in making all these missions to go and get all these slaves. And I'm looking for my notes, y'all. I'm struggling here. I'm sorry.
I think they say that she was like 12 or 13 years old, and you're correct. She was at a store or that venue, and there was a slave that they were trying to apprehend, and a white individual actually did throw a 2-pound iron weight at the slave, but it accidentally hit her in the head. And from that point on, she pretty much caused her to have seizures, and she started having trouble with narcolepsy, where she would just fall asleep, and she was having severe headaches as well. But that was the backdrop, and she said that from that point on that she had started to have dreams and visions that the Lord wanted her to free slaves, free herself, and then free slaves as well.
I found that very interesting. And I also found something interesting about her is when they said she described crossing, because, you know, she became free herself when she fled over into Pennsylvania. And she said she described crossing into the state of Pennsylvania for the first time. She described it as having a relief and an awe. And she said that she found that as she crossed that line, she looked at her hands to see if she was the same person. She said there was such a glory everywhere. The sun, she said, was like gold coming through the trees and over the fields, and it felt like I was in heaven. So I can't even imagine. I mean, it kind of makes me tear up. I can't even imagine, first of all, being a slave, but I can only envision what it must have felt like to go from on one side of the line, you're still a slave, and then crossing over the line, and then suddenly you're finding freedom for the first time. So that had to be very emotional. You know what I mean? We've never seen that in our lifetime, but you can only imagine how the slaves must have felt when they reach freedom. You know.
Well, and some of the slaves that invariably had been living in that life, and it was a generational pretty much acceptance by some, because that's all that individuals knew. I'm a slave, and I've been born into a slave environment. But some slaves started to really think about the concept of slavery, and they came up with the conclusion that it was wrong. And so then it started to be small pockets and splinter groups of individuals who not only now knew that it was wrong, but now they were starting to devise, well, how can we affect our situation or in terms of escape? And that's a lot of what started to happen. And then they had abolitionists who helped the cause in the move, but then they had individuals that were breaking away, slaves themselves, to free themselves and then free others. And that was an integral part of what Harriet Tubman started to do early on.
And, you know, another thing I found fascinating is that she made over 19 trips, you know, to do this, and she freed over 300 people. And it is said that she said she could have freed more slaves if they had only known they were slaves. So, you know, it speaks to just what you just said, Christopher. You know, that's all they knew. And so just, trying to wrap their mind around, you know, what do I do? What will be my new life if I leave here? A lot of them could not see that as their reality. So that caused them to not go on with her and find freedom, which I just found crazy. I mean, but I guess if that's your normal, if that's all you know, that's all you know. You know, and fear, I guess, gripped them, and a lot of them would not go on with her or would not find freedom with her because she said they never knew they were slaves. because they're normal. Well,
and that's what? True. You're absolutely right. That was the norm. And the interesting thing about Harriet Tubman, really, even before she started going down herself in the Underground Railroad and partnering with other abolitionists and some of the Quakers, she actually devised and assisted with the safe routes. And even when, because she went down two or three times a year when she would go down to make her rounds to actually liberate and free slaves, but there were other things going on where she actually assisted some of the Quakers because, I mean, traditionally most people know as Harriet Tubman going back into the Deep South after she escaped herself, which was true. But there were also other missions that she, while she was doing other things, she led other individuals and taught them how to do that as well. So a lot of people don't know. She was actually teaching people to do what she was doing. And you're right. There was one thing where she said that she carried her pistol, and the only time that she would have to use it against, she called them her passengers, is if someone decided they were not, you know, if they started out with her and then they decided they didn't want to go any further. She said she killed them where they stood.
Did she? You know,
yes,
they said they called her Moses.
She couldn't have nobody, to, you know, finding out the passage and everything. So that was her disclaimer. When you agreed that you were going to go in the Underground Railroad with her, that you could not turn back. And if you did turn back, she would shoot you where you stood dead.
That's crazy. They said they called her Moses because she never lost a passenger. I mean, that was incredible for somebody in her time. I mean, she was – I mean, we're talking about this is 1820 to 1913. I mean, you know, go figure. And she was that bad. And you just have to call her what she was. She was a bad chick. And they often called her either – I think in her early years she was called Minty. But in later years they called her Moses just because
Moses.
She was – Moses, she was just that bad. I mean, that's just, you know.
She was a very smart, very intelligent woman. I mean, when people used to hear the slaves sing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, that was actually a code song that when a slave would sing that song, that was them saying, hey, I'm willing to go when Harriet, the next time she comes down through this way, I'm willing to go with her in the Underground Railroad. So that's how she and other slaves knew that was somebody who was willing to take their chances and hit the Underground Railroad. So they sang that song. The white slave master didn't know what was going on, but the slaves did.
AJ, who did you come across that you felt like a certain attraction to?
Well, then I was just amazed at a lot of things that's never covered in when we go to Black History Month. I think we all go to the same people and same things. So I had a whole list, a whole host of folks that I was impressed with. But one person, I tried to start with the earliest, you know, and
yeah.
You know, all the way back to 1746.
Ooh.
Because this lady, Lucy Terry, she's the first known, she wrote the first known poem by an African-American, not just a black woman, by an African-American. But her poem wasn't published. It was only published after Phyllis Wheatley did her first publication.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I went and read some of her poetry. You know, it was Bar's Fight was her first poem. It was pretty interesting, but it was just the fact that you never knew that there was this black woman, the first poet in the United States, first known poem, was written by her. You know, I'm quite sure a lot of things were written before, but I think that was one that was passed around and everybody knew about it.
And she was a poet. Did you find any of her pieces that you can read?
Yeah. Well, the Bar's Fight, let me pull it up. Here you go.
Tonight, y'all, we're just trying to do something different. Everybody does, like AJ said, the same thing on Black History Month. You know, everybody talks about, you know, they'll have some cute kid who will do the Martin Luther King speech, or, you know, we'll talk about Frederick Douglass and some of the other greats or giants, as I'm calling them tonight. But tonight we wanted to just take a whole night and just look at just, you know, how many women were instrumental in making, you know, the Civil Rights Movement what it was. And there were many. And it ranged from bringing folks through slavery to freedom to, you know, getting us off of the back of the bus to the front of the bus and some other things and being the first to, what do they call the school in Mississippi where the, how many was it that went to the school in Mississippi and were escorted by the National Guard? How many was that? The Mississippi, I mean, the Arkansas, I forgot what they call them. Yeah, I got to find my notes. But there's many people that have a role in helping to call the civil rights movement what it was. I mean, and we, every year, we take just 28 days and look at who we consider great, and it's always the same people, but there's so many other people behind the scenes whose names are never called. Did you find it, AJ?
Yeah, I found it. Well, the poem that she was popular for was Bars Fight, and that was the first one. And it actually says, Samuel Allen like a hero fought, and though he was so brave and bold, his face no more shall we behold. Elijah Hawks was killed outright before he had time to fight. Before he did, the Indian Sea was shot and killed immediately. Oliver Amsden, he was slain, which caused his friends much grief and pain. Samuel Amson, they found dead, not many rods off from his head. Anajah Gillett, we do hear, those did lose his life, which was so dear. John Sadler fed across water, and so escaped the dreadful slaughter. Eunice Allen, see the Indians coming, and hoped to save herself by running, and had not her petticoat stopped her. The awful creatures had not catched her, and Tommy hawked her on the head and left her on the ground for dead. Young Sammy Allen, oh, lack of day, was taken and carried to Canada. And that's the whole poem. But she was actually telling of the names of people that was killed in this fight against the Indians, and she actually put all the names in there. So I think it was like almost like a first-hand account. But what she did, I'm saying, she was considered a singer, a composer. She composed poetry, and she translated for other, and she was a great speaker and a great storyteller.
It says
she became the first African American woman to argue a case in front of the Supreme Court of the United States.
That's what I'm talking about. And AJ has an affection for her because he himself is a poet. I never heard of her, and you're right, AJ, I never heard of her when it comes to Black History Month because we talk about the same people, you know, over. And we're hoping tonight we're going to bring up some names that y'all never heard before to introduce you to people that were part of helping to put us where we are today. And, you know, speaking of a portion of what AJ mentioned in that poem is – we got to remember, you know, we aren't just talking about people who were just fighting for equality. We're talking about people who were fighting for freedom. I mean, so the closest thing we can really relate to it is when we saw Roots. And, you know, y'all, we saw people hanging from trees and roots and stuff like that. And we thought, wow. But this was some people's reality. So fighting to be free could mean that you had to pay the ultimate price, which was your life. Because some folks didn't make it, freedom.
And see, a lot of them, when you look them up, they say, you know, writer, poet, singer, whatever, lecturer, abolitionist. But then some of them, you have abolitionist and activist. So it meant that abolitionist was somebody who was fighting for rights but not really actively. And activist means that they were willing to give up their life for the fight.
I mean, it was a lot going on back then. I mean, because you had people who were trying – I mean, with everything they had to keep you oppressed. I mean, and if it meant, you know, you fighting for your freedom would cause you, you know, to get to a point where they felt like they couldn't control you anymore, they just killed you. I mean, because I think back then, wasn't it more about instilling fear in the masses? So if they had to kill a few to get the rest under control, that's what they did?
What they would do is they would find one to beat for whatever reason. And they beat them to the white meat was showing them bloody. So they would know, you know, when they walk around and they pop the whip, you don't know if you're going to be the next one beat. Or if they ran, they would cut their Achilles tendon. but they couldn't run. So it was all these things. So when Tubman wanted people on the railroad to go, a lot of people were so in fear of that particular master because each plantation was different. Some masters probably wasn't as hard as others, but some were just adamant and had a black person, had a black spy in the plantation. Hey, yeah. Old Bobby thinking about running, master. Master Bobby thinking about running. They go get Bobby, even if he wasn't. They go get Bobby and beat him to a pulp or maybe lynch him. Just to let everybody know, hey, don't be thinking about running from here. You are my property. You owe me this amount of things. So it was a whole different concept when you really look in detail at the whole case. It's like, man, I can either stay here and pick cotton or I can die. That was the only two options.
And, yeah, and it really makes you sad because, you know, one of the things that I thought about as I was thinking of how to produce the show was how far we've gone backwards. You know, these people fought so hard to get to a point where we could be free and have equal rights as everybody else. And today it looks like we're slowly moving backwards. And so it just makes you wonder, you know, do we ever really consider that people pay the ultimate price with their life for us to get where we are today? And yet, you know, we're not acting like we free. We ain't acting like we, you know, really cared about the struggle that other people, you know, had to go through to get us to this point. It's just like we're not really caring or we don't care about what the price was paid.
No, so I think what it is, you know, when you run across the finish line and you ran this whole race, and you jubilant and you celebrating. I think we've been in celebration mode ever since the March on Washington.
We forgot.
So we hadn't noticed all these changes around us. We still celebrating.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what we forgot? The fight wasn't over. Well, you know,
Exactly.
The fight was over. And we stopped fighting after Dr. It seemed like to me after Dr. King died, I think that took the fight out of us. And, you know, I think, well, let me take that back. I think when we lost Malcolm and Dr. King, I think that took the win out of a lot of people. And a lot of people have not admitted to this day they just gave up at that point. They just gave up.
Well, then, even if you look at Dr. King's situation, you had Ralph Abernathy, you had Andrew Young, you had Jesse Jackson, you had all these prominent leaders with him.
Mm-hmm.
It was like when he died, Jesse Jackson went and started doing Operation Push. Andrew Young went and became a governor, and Abernathy went back to preaching. It was like, well, mm-hmm. we can go home now because they really killing niggas up here.
You know what? He's spot on, and the nail is in the coffin. I mean, the bottom line is that I think what's being said in terms of getting near the finish line but not actually crossing the threshold,
yeah.
A lot of people, I think, became very disenchanted and did not fully realize that Dr. King had done his job. He brought you where you needed to be to the forefront. But people, I think after those two, with him and Malcolm X, I think you're exactly right, that a lot of people – they became distant from the struggle. And I will honestly say myself, unequivocally, in 2008 when I was wrongfully arrested, I will say that further polarized my involvement in the movement and civil rights because, I guess I would call myself, I was involved, but I wasn't involved. I did a little bit of this, but I mean now, my level of involvement is where I am actually willing, if that means that I would have to be injured or give my life for the sake of the struggle and for justice, I'm willing to do that because I understand what I'm saying, but I also understand the relevance and why it is necessary.
I don't
fully grasp that.
I don't think we understand. See, everybody called it a movement, but nobody really said what a movement was. See, a movement is like a song or whatever. It goes from one place to the next because if you remember down in when they were in Mississippi or in Alabama and they had this struggle going on, when those people were arrested, the Freedom Riders and other people came down. They moved down there to take their place. So the movement is that always somebody's moving for the same cause. And I think that's what we lost. So I don't think that we didn't win the race when King was marching. That was one race we had won. But there were so many more races to go, and everybody thought we were done.
Wow. You know what? I didn't think of it that way, but now that you mention it, Dr. King, Malcolm X, and they did move around. I mean, he was in Memphis for the garbage worker strike. I mean, he was down in Alabama. I mean, he was all over the place. And so you are right. And I think sometimes when people see situations, it's like with Sister Maggie Rose. I mean, I never really envisioned myself going, you know, we had the Trayvon Martin rally here in Chicago. They had it across the nation simultaneously. But you're right. The movement means that means that you may have to pick up and go to go someplace and support somebody other than just prayer or a telephone call. And some people, I don't think they have that concept. They're not going nowhere to support us.
Well, if you remember when in the wars back then, they had the front line, they had people behind them. When the front line went up and fired their weapons, and when they were shot, another man moved right in his place and took his spot.
Mm.
That's the movement.
Okay.
The movement is that you don't lose anything. It's that we head into where we're going. It might take a whole bunch of us to get there. But the movement was everybody willing to sacrifice, willing to go to jail and don't have bail money, willing to look at the dogs and the hoses and willing to fight these fights. You know, but there's a whole lot of women that people don't know anything about that I found, man. I was just so I was so enamored, man, with a couple of women. I was trying to find this. There was this one lady, man, I read about. I was like, wow.
Well, while you look for her, I'll tell you about Sojourner Truth. How about that?
Okay,
Sojourner Truth, y'all. And I'm sure y'all have heard her name before, but I found her to be just like, I don't know, a bad mama jamma, if you will. Sojourner Truth was born, seriously, 1797. She died November 26, 1883. At age 11, she was sold for $100 with a flock of sheep, y'all. She experienced sexual abuse and whippings by her master, which she wrote about later in her life. But this woman went on to become an African-American abolitionist, as A.J. mentioned earlier, a preacher and a women's rights activist. Truth was born into slavery, but escaped with her infant daughter to freedom in 1826. 1826, y'all. After going to court to recover her son, she became the first black woman to win such a case against a white man. She was born Isabel Bumfrey when she was born, but gave herself the name Sojourner Truth. She was best known for her extemporaneous speech on gender inequalities. The speech was called Ain't I a Woman, and she delivered it in 1851 at the Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio. During the Civil War, y'all, they said that Truth also helped recruit black troops for the Union Army after the war. And then it says that she even went on to try to sue the government for land grants for former slaves. I mean, that's just how bad she was back in the 1800s. She worked with Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison. They said the Sojourner Truth was not even able to read or write, but she was so smart that she dictated her memoirs to a friend of hers, and it was later published by William Lloyd Garrison in 1850. They said that she preached on street corners with an evangelist, evangelical missionary by the name of Elijah Pearson. In 1864, she went to Washington, D.C., where she helped to integrate streetcars. Now, this is before Rosa Parks, y'all. This is in 1864. She went to Washington, D.C., where she helped to integrate streetcars and received at the White House, and was received at the White House, rather, by Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, y'all. I mean, this is just how bad she was. And they said that she stood 6 feet tall, and she had this very powerful voice. She spoke English with a Dutch accent. So can you imagine, can't read or write, but you're 6 feet tall with a powerful voice, and you speak in English, but you sound like you're Dutch.
Wow.
That was her journey. And I just want her to be so bad, huh? I just found her, you know, the fact that she stood so tall and she had such a powerful voice, and the fact that she was able to give a speech without notes, you know, unrehearsed, you know, for the most part, and stood up there at that convention and just stole the show. And so those are the kind of people, you know, when I look at these women, I'm wondering, what are we doing today and why aren't we doing what these people have done? These are milestones that have already been crossed, but we're not doing those things today.
Because we're watching cat videos and every funny video they send out and, you know, copying little poster boards with somebody else's quote on them and passing them around as though it's our original piece of art.
Yeah.
So
we're not original anymore.
But that's what I'm saying. We copying those little squares and with somebody else's quotes on them, posting them, you know, as though it's our original art. But I think what it was is when you are the creator of something, you don't need notes.
When you are
the forceful fighter of any given cause, when they ask you what it is, you can tell them what it is verbatim because you are the cause. And see, we don't have anybody willing to fight for anything right now. Everybody's, you know, wants to be given it, or I think they need to work for somebody else that's going to pay them good money so they don't have to use their own mind or use their own words or use their own actions anymore.
Well, you know, I think in terms of civil rights and the whole, and I'm sorry, if y'all just tuned in, you've come center stage tonight for the topic, famous black female leaders of the civil rights movement. We're talking about people like Harriet Tubman, Fannie Lou Hamer, Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, Mahalia Jackson, Nikki Giovanni, Susan B. Anthony, Lena Horne, and so many others. You know, and tonight what we're trying to do is show you that the civil rights movement was more than about strong black men. It also had a lot of female giants in it. And so tonight we just thought, you know, Black History Month, what would it be without us talking about the queens that were a part of the movement? So that's where we're at tonight, just looking at some maybe you heard of, others that, you know, you may be hearing for the first time, but they had pivotal roles in the civil rights movement. And we just wanted to take tonight and just say that, you know, hats off to these black women, and hopefully we'll have some other strong female leaders that will follow them. Y'all agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. AJ, did you find who you were looking for?
Yeah, I did, but I'm saying we could just go on and talk about who's ever on everybody's list. We get to it because I don't think we need to go in order. What one point I wanted to make was like Harriet Beecher Stowe in 1811 wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and you know that movie's been produced probably every 5 or 10 years they redo that movie, and I bet she's not getting no money for it. Her family and her legacy is, you know, she's attributed to writing it, but I don't think anybody really cares. They just want to see the show.
We won't even go into probably the ideas that were probably stolen. Even today, black people are having ideas stolen. So can you imagine all the black females that probably created things back in the day?
She was attributed to writing. Now what's going on now is they're actually stealing the rights to your work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
She was attributed to writing it. They just, you know, they just borrowed her work to do some other things with it.
Sure. Well, Christopher, tell us a little bit about Fannie Lou Hamer.
Wow. You know, a little bit about her. Well, the one thing is that she was born on October 1917, actually 4 years after Harriet Tubman died. She was the youngest of 20 children. So she came from a large family, and I didn't know that. Her parents were sharecroppers, and they lived down in the Delta along in the Mississippi. She began actually working in the fields when she was 6 years old. And at 12 years old, she dropped out of school in order to work full-time to help support her family. And then she pretty much went into being a sharecropper on a cotton plantation for a number of years. In 1944, she got married to a gentleman named Perry Pop Hamer, and they both then jointly worked on cotton plantation. She didn't have any children. Back then, the black folks were treated very bad, even when they were allowed to have white surgeons perform procedures on them. But she had a cervical tumor, And the doctor, instead of just removing the tumor, he did a total hysterectomy and didn't tell her, just did it while she was on the anesthesia. And so she wasn't able to have children because of that. So in a lot of these cases, like we were talking about, a lot of black individuals didn't have any recourse. A lot of litigation and laws and so forth were just not set up. But in 1962, she was asked to go attend a meeting that was dealing with civil rights and specifically voting rights, because since she was from Mississippi, Mississippi was one of the last holdouts dealing with voting rights and just civil rights. And so they held on to the very last minute. But she went to a protest meeting, and at that meeting she met other civil rights leaders and activists. And then in 1962, her and 17 other individuals traveled in Mississippi to the county that they lived in, and they were demanding the right to register and vote. Of course, they were opposed by law enforcement. Several of them were arrested, and I think this was her first brush with the law, dealing with civil rights. But once she then returned home from this rally, her and her husband were fired at the plantation for over 20 years. At that point, she pretty much had made a statement that said, they kicked me off the plantation, and now I'm free. Now I can work for my people. And that was her defining moment, where she went full-fledged into the civil rights movement and for voting rights. She pretty much decided to dedicate her life. First thing that she did is that she got with a lot of the students in the different various colleges and universities in Mississippi, and she was co-founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee. Basically, she encouraged black students to do sit-ins, nonviolent protests, and civil disobedience. And in 1962, she was doing a voters' rights protest, and she was arrested. She was beaten, and she was beaten so severely that she ended up having permanent kidney damage. Mm. So she got death threats, and she was shot at several times and so forth. In 1964, she founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and this organization was established to oppose the states, because in Mississippi, their delegations were all white. So she was trying to petition to get black individuals to be able to protest and then become a part of these delegation or get voted in and so forth, but she had to affect the voters' rights in Mississippi. So I put it in this perspective, Fannie Lou Hamer and others, but Fannie Lou Hamer were one of the monumental black women that actually kind of forged that piece in Mississippi's history that actually allowed the civil rights and the freedom rights movement to be more productive in Mississippi. She essentially laid the groundwork. She died in 1977 from breast cancer, but she linked up with everybody from Dr. Martin Luther King to many other civil rights activists, and worked diligently up until her home going. But she basically came from that mentality of, you know, sharecropper doing this, not really understanding and being involved, and then she was exposed to that, and pretty much from that point, she gave up everything. I mean, she may or may not have known that when she first started off that would cost her job, but when she looks back on it, in hindsight, I mean, she said that was probably one of the best things that ever happened, because that may not have created that environment for her to actually then branch out and then pursue the voting rights in Mississippi, which eventually the civil rights movement and the sacrifices did get the right to vote in Mississippi as well.
Hmm. Wow. She sounds like quite a woman.
Yes.
It sounds like quite a woman. And you know what? And the thing is, most of the – and I thought about it as you were talking about part of what you were talking about – so much of what we look at today as a job is really like the new slavery, because we're really not ever going to get rich for the most part. But we look at our jobs the same way that the slaves looked at their jobs in slavery. I mean, if you really think about when Harriet Tubman was trying to free him, and a lot of them said that, you know, they didn't want to go because that's all they knew. That's the way we look at today. We're afraid to branch out on our own because we don't have any idea of what the new normal will be like if we decide to do something for ourselves.
Well, you're right, for ourselves, but a lot of people, like you said, they have that slave mentality. And mm-hmm. if it's something that's for me, that's going to save my hide, then I'm all in. But what if that means I have to take some bread off my table or some time off my table or put myself in a situation that could get me arrested? It may mean I may lose my job. I'm to that point, but I'm trying to encourage other individuals, although they may not be to that point, that you have to put something into it. You can't just Facebook and Instagram and so forth, and that's good. But a lot of people, it's just like they just don't get beyond that in terms of doing something more than just basically running your mouth. What are you doing to affect?
Number two, I think the first thing that people have to do is understand that they have a purpose. And when you are enthralled and you go for your purpose as though there's no options, then the rest of it is automatic because you know what it feels like to go for something with, you know, it's do or die, you know, because that was really a word back then, do or die. Either you're going to do it or you're going to die. But either way, you're going to try it. but see, so many people now will fall back on their own dreams, will change their mind in mid-stride just because it seems a little hard. So we're not used to hard. We're kind of used to easy. We're the fast food revelation people. We think work is fast food. We think our purpose is fast food. We think our destiny is fast food because we want to get there, but we don't want the struggles and things that it takes. We don't want the lessons.
Well, you know what? It's funny we're talking about, you know, strong female civil rights leaders because if the truth be known, in a lot of cases, and we talked about this on a previous show, the women in some cases are stronger than the men today. Men wanted, not all men, but a lot of men are not willing to make any sacrifices like back in the day. You know, some brothers were willing to, like, you know, again, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, they were willing to put it all on the line. Where are those brothers today?
No, finish, Carol, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, I'm saying, where are those brothers at today?
No. My point is this, is that, see, I think it was like almost 15 years ago, most of the schools in Dallas, I'm originally from Dallas, most schools in Dallas had male principals. They started replacing the men with female principals.
Yep.
And then you start seeing on the TV shows, they start having women superheroes. But see, I think the man, especially the black man, was slowly phased out. And it wasn't that nobody's trying, it's just that nobody's listening, you know, because there's a difference. Because when the media has the ability to shine a light on somebody else, see, they'll shine a light on a black rapper or a black singer, but not somebody black doing something positive, because that's not the light they want to see. You know, so all these things are phased out. And when you highlight the woman, it makes, we have enough families with single-parent families that are raised by women, but we have a lot of single-parent families that are raised by men, but those are never shown. So as long as... Say again?
But that's that whole New World Order agenda where everything is wrong, that was wrong is right, and everything that was right is now wrong. So that obviously that's been moving in that direction for a while, and that women's lib, and y'all listen, I am a woman and a strong black woman. Don't ever get that twisted. But I do see certain things in which have happened over the course of time since the women's liberation movement where we've kind of lost our femininity in this whole thing, and we can get our own doors, and we can, you know, do some of the things that men used to automatically do for us. And it's not a bad thing, in my opinion, but everything is twisted now. Let's just say that everything that was right is wrong. And you're right. Everything has become women are more masculine and men are more feminine, which is crazy.
But another thing, Carrie, is I'm saying you have no clue how many black men that are doing positive things are followed by the police in their own city, in their own neighborhood. And you know, stopping. And a lot of times when this happens, they do lose their jobs and they do this because now you went to jail for nothing, but even though they didn't charge you with anything substantial, you still got to fight to get free. So now you have this criminal record. So it's a lot of things going on that are the underlying factors of a lot of things that we don't look at.
You know, this is how I see the whole thing, the way it was playing out, and it's really odd, is that there's so many people that are calling themselves playing it safe. I'm not going to make any waves. You know, if anybody else needs my help, I'm not going to go out there and put my neck out because it's not bothering me and my household. When in reality, the world is under attack. So you can sit on the porch or on the couch, play it safe, never come out until the bomb hits the house. But at some point, the bomb is still going to hit the house. So you can fight now or fight later, but the fight is getting closer and closer. I mean, and I just see so many people cowardly, you know, cowardly. The Bible says he does not give us the spirit of fear. And so if you have the spirit of fear, that did not come from God on any level. And so when we're cowardly, you know, kind to trying to act as though we don't want to be a part of the struggle because the struggle ain't affecting me. I got a car, I got a house, I got a job. So what am I, you know, going to be out there fighting for? In reality, you're losing all of that daily. I mean, period. I mean, and I don't mean to be on a soapbox, but I really see that when we're talking about these strong black women and the sacrifices that they made. Today, you don't see anybody wanting to make a sacrifice, but in reality, it's now or later, but it's going to happen.
But I think
because
out of habit,
all under attack.
I think out of habit, so many people think it doesn't affect them because, you know, a lot of times you don't really worry about something until it's in your neighborhood. Just like when crack was brought into the black community, it was all right. But when it started going over to North Dallas and other places, it was an epidemic.
So I'm saying there
are things you can see how it progressed into something else on how we became complacent. Not really complacent. It was just a habit that we saw it so much that we just thought it was a natural occurrence in our community.
But you know what?
When
we stopped fighting for what was right, that's when we lost this whole generation. You know, while everybody said at the house, it's not my kids is acting up, it's they kids is acting up. Now it's your kids is acting up. You know, and so we're losing a whole generation while everybody is playing it safe.
Well, you got to taking prayer out of public schools. Then so many other things were deleted in that process because it used to be that you had some pride about something. But now when you grow up as a child, if you don't have pride about your community, about your nation, about all these other things, you grow up, it's all about self.
Yeah.
So when you're a teenager and you get to be 20 or whatever, you're not worried about anything because you were trained to think about self. It's a training process that we've been missing.
You were saying what, Christopher?
And I was going to say, in adding to that, that's why, I mean, I started listening a little bit more closely to what Dr. King was saying. And he said one statement that is very profound. He talked about how injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So what that means is that If AJ calls me up and says, hey, you know what, Chris, we got a crazy mayor who's acting up down here and we're trying to put together something to mobilize and to protest against this, that means, to me, that's my brother. So I need to try to work something out, whether it's financial support, whether I can physically go there and support him. Because the thing is that just because he's in another state, there's going to be a time where I got to leave Chicago to go somewhere else to help my brother and my sister. I'm supposed to be my brother and my sister's keeper for that very reason. But see, some people, they tolerate it, and they don't realize that if I see somebody breaking in my neighbor's house, I can't be comfortable and say, well, at least they ain't breaking in my house, because eventually they're going to try and break in your house. So I got to stand with my neighbor so that we can eradicate that behavior and that bad conduct
But I got to do it because it is not just, you know, that old cliche, it's the right thing to do. But I got to do it because it's wrong, number one. And if I don't do something about it, it's going to be exactly on me one day.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I 100%. And it's amazing how, you know, and we're going to get to Rosa Parks in a minute, but, you know, that whole boycott on Montgomery was so powerful because those people decided that it's now or never, you know, and when the church leaders got together and told their congregations what to do, they did it. And it wasn't a whole bunch of preachers who were driving around in Rolls Royces and private jets. These were just everyday preachers trying to make it, but they had a significant impact on their congregations. And when they told them what they needed to do, those people did it. And they made a really, really, I mean, it was, the sacrifice that they had to make was incredible in order to get some progress, but they decided that they would do it. Today, nobody is willing to sacrifice anything. You know what I'm saying? I'm not going to give my financial support. I'm not going to lend a hand. I'm not going to write a letter. I'm not going to make a phone call. I'm just not going to get involved. But those are the same people that want to benefit from other people's struggle. That's just what it is. I mean, Say what?
No, I'm saying the black church was the first safe house. It was the first place that a black man could actually have a voice in this country.
Mm.
So at that time, the black church was the most profound place to go because everybody knew that this is the place where I can go and be a man.
Mm.
So that's why you had all these leaders coming out of the church and they had that minister attached to their names. Because they learn. See, speaking is a learned process. Being on the podium is a learned process. So you have a lot of people that want to speak but don't know how to speak when they're in front of an audience. But but when they learn this process and they say, okay, you just like Dr. King, he was kind of the Moses of it. He'd say, no, man, I just want to be the pastor of the church. I didn't come out here to do this, you know. And just like, and Lena Horne was that way too. That's why
really?
She was blacklisted. Yeah, she was blacklisted. She was doing a lot of movies in Hollywood at first. And she was blacklisted because of her political views, because she was marching with Malcolm and hanging out with Evers and doing all the other things and you know, hanging out in the Harlem Renaissance and hanging out with all these black folks that was talking this positive mess.
Hmm. Let me show y'all how organized black people were. We're going to talk about Rosa Louise McCauley Parks, also known as Rosa Parks. She was born February 4th, 1913, and she died October 24th, 2005. She was an African-American civil rights activist whom the United States Congress called the First Lady of the Civil Rights and the mother of the Freedom Movement. On December 1st, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, Parks refused to obey bus driver James Blake's order to give up her seat in the colored section of the bus because the white section had become full. And this wasn't something new because Irene Morgan in 1946 and Sarah Louise Keyes in 1955 had both done the same thing and been arrested. However, the NAACP felt that Rosa Parks was the best candidate to challenge in court the arrest for civil disobedience. And so what happened was Parks' act of defiance basically started the boycott. And on December 4th, 1955, they set a plan in motion to boycott the bus system. On December 5th, the WPC distributed some 35,000 leaflets. And this is what I'm talking about when I speak to they came together and decided we're going to do this. The leaflet read like this, y'all. It says, we are asking every Negro to stay off the buses Monday in protest of the arrest and trial. You can afford to stay out of school one day. If you work, take a cab or walk. But please, children and grown-ups, don't ride the bus at all Monday. Please stay off the bus Monday. That's what the leaflet said. And they circulated some 35,000 of these. And they said blacks carpooled. They used black operated cabs. And they walked some as far as 20 miles. And after the first day was so successful, that's when they decided to bring in Dr. King, because they felt like the boycott needed some organization to it, let's just say that. And so Dr. King stepped in. The boycott lasted 381 days, y'all. It's only 365 days in a year. So that was a little over a year these people chose to do this. But after 381 days, their result was that dozens of buses stood idle for months, and that severely damaged the bus transit company. And so it hit their pocketbook so hard that the city repealed this law requiring segregation on public buses. But that's what unity will do. And that's what we don't see enough of today. They unified. They decided, listen, we got to do what we got to do. If we need to circulate 35,000 flyers so every black person knows what to do, they did it. And that's what happened. And that's what we don't see today, y'all. We don't see that.
But Terry, you left out the fight after the fourth week.
Okay.
Everybody said we were just going to do it for a day. We were just going to do it a couple of weeks, but we can't. So the fight was, so that was probably Martin's first major decision, because they called him in, you know, and they say, okay, we'll give you this and this. But they were trying to make concessions so they ride the bus so they could make money. But
mm-hmm.
when they met with Martin saying, man, we could take this deal, and Martin said, no, they're not giving us what we want. So when they walked out of that meeting, that's when everybody was saying, man, we had them where we want them. And they said, no, we have them where we want them now. So the argument was you had all these black folks that was willing to give in at that point because they felt like the fight was over. But you had all
but see, again,
people
they had
the
a leader.
When yeah. But
somebody
saying,
was smart enough to bring in Martin to organize. Right?
But I'm saying that was Martin's decision to keep going. But everybody was going against Martin because they said, no, man, we can't keep doing this, you know. Because some people were getting up so early in the morning driving so many different people to work because everybody didn't have a car. So it was all these people that was inconvenienced, and some people were tired of being inconvenienced.
Did we lose AJ?
I think so.
Did we lose you, AJ? I think we lost AJ.
Oh.
I guess they said cut that off.
All right. You're right. Well, you know what? He has a very valid point, and I see where he's coming from. The other thing that I was thinking as AJ was saying that is that they had a leader who was not only talking, but he was doing the walking too. In other words, Martin Luther King and a lot of these black women that we're talking about, the profoundness was that they were in it to win it. So if that meant that you didn't eat, I don't eat. If we only got one piece of bread, we split that piece of bread. But a lot of people today, they have more, I think a lot of us have more than we should have, but we have more than a lot of our just had and our grandparents and parents had. But a lot of people, I don't think they see the value in the sacrifice. And the sacrifice means that I have to use. First of all, I'm a steward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a steward over what I have. And the people in the 50s and the 60s, they were down for it. That meant that, oh, okay, you got fired because they saw you downtown marching with us and you got put off your apartment. Okay, Brother Neckbone and Sister Hemhock, y'all going to come stay with me. We not going to let you stay out the street because you were down for the cause.
Or we going to have a rent party for you. They ain't doing that no more.
No, rent, what? Then they're looking at you crazy because you don't have rent or because they was like, well, you know, we get with that Sambo House Negro mentality. Well, you know, I need my job. I don't want no trouble. Well, I don't want no trouble either. But the thing is that sometimes we have to do those things that may get us outside of that comfort zone. A lot of people, they're not trying to be uncomfortable.
They're not. Hey, AJ, whatever you were saying was so important, they decided to cut you off.
I knew it. But the main point I was making is that, see, Martin was put in a position he wasn't really ready for, but he was prepared for, if that makes sense.
He wasn't ready, but
okay.
He was prepared.
Sure.
So
sure.
So when they approached him, he heard all these different sides from all these people he thought was on his side that was really against him now because they wanted him to give in. You know, we got him where we want him, and they wanted him to give in. And he was thinking, like, you know, this might help us over in this section, but it's not helping them over in that section. So until everybody is helped, we can't give in.
Okay.
And that's
there
what we're missing now. We want to make things better for us, not make things better. There's always
but
a difference.
But you know what?
It matters
right, we're making things better for us individually, but we're not thinking about making things better for us as a group, as a people.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I'm saying. We want to make things better. We want to make things better, but if we get better for us, we're satisfied.
Okay, y'all, we got to go to the phone line. Somebody keeps jumping up and down. We want to see what they're talking about. Good evening. Your number is blocked. You're on Center Stage.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, how are you doing?
I'm good, and you?
I'm good. I'm listening to the conversation. I just wanted to respond to what the woman said about the sacrifices that were made, and I forget exactly what she said, but something along the lines of people don't appreciate the sacrifices that were made. And I could say, like I'm only 31 years old, which to some people may be old, which to other people may be young. I kind of fall in between, I guess. But the problem with the whole civil rights movement was that it was a bit short-sighted. Too many black people fed into the concept of joining white people and that white people were going to share, you know, the whole system with us. There was a bit of entitlement that was there, which, I mean, obviously the entitlement was warranted because black people were most certainly owed. But the problem is that in joining, you know, white people or joining the white system or as we thought was going to happen, nothing was set up. Black people didn't maintain anything. You know, meaning like I can go into a Chinatown, and you know it's Chinatown when you go into a Chinatown. There's Chinese businesses on both sides of the street. Black people don't have that. You know, during the civil rights movement, I mean, pretty much everybody went to work, punched the clock, and you know, along with the deindustrialization of America, and black people not controlling any aspect of any business within the confines of their own community. You know, the mass exodus of educated blacks leaving their communities, not building it up, not being, I hate using the term role model, but not being the people who were in control of the economic opportunities in their own environment to set the standard and set the tone for younger people to want to follow that. So now pretty much what you have is anytime a black person thinks about success or wants to be successful, you got to get out the black community. You can't even have a successful lifestyle, you know, as it's envisioned in the black community. You know, if you want a nice house, you can't have that in the black community. If you want a nice car, you can't, you know, African or black people don't even manufacture a car. Everything we consume, we do not make. There's not a single thing that we consume that we make. I mean, from the hair care products to the, you know, to the clothes that we buy, we don't make them. And so I think that's one. I mean, Martin Luther King kind of pushed in that direction because he realized it wasn't so much about the whole racial aspect, and he was going into, like around 1968, he was going into the whole, you know, war against poverty, the whole economic aspect, and then he was assassinated, and then that just kind of fizzled and died. But he was heading in the right direction, which is it's about the money. It's about economic empowerment. And I feel that, you know, too many black people were trying to join, you know, the white community. And even when you look at some of the, like I have a brother that had a whole list. He had a whole list of black civil rights leaders, all male. And, you know, I mean, the same guy who came up with the phrase black power married not one white woman, but two white women. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, did you, like, were you trying to integrate because you wanted, you know, you were one of those kids that failed the doll test and you wanted to be around white people and you had self-hate? Or were you trying to integrate, you know, because you wanted your people to have access to the tools that white people hadn't denied you? You see, there's a difference. So it's like, once that was pointed out, I was kind of, you know, looking at it like, well, I see why, you know, you have sisters that don't trust brothers and don't want to follow them and all that other stuff. And that's a whole different conversation. I'm just saying, you know, black leadership has failed. And so in I was just going to say, in terms of young people, it's very hard for us to look to the older generation as, you know, these people to be inspired by, because a lot of them didn't do the right thing and they didn't want to do the right thing.
So you're only 31 years old, so you really weren't around when, you know, the civil rights movement was pretty much ending. But you feel like really as far as segregation was concerned, we should not have integrated, we should have stayed segregated, and therefore we would have been a stronger community?
No other group that comes here, no other group, and the issue is that we've been here too long, okay?
Right.
I remember I was having a conversation with my Pakistani friend's mother, and, you know, I was having a conversation about the community, black community, and this, that, and the third. And, you know, she was, I remember the conversation, we made a whole bunch of points, but she said, but you all are foreigners too. And I was like, yeah, I was like, funny how you know that we're foreigners. I got to turn this other phone off. Funny how you know we're foreigners, but we don't know that we're foreigners. We black people have an entitlement. I mean, and it makes sense because, you know, black people have shed a lot of blood in this nation. I mean, we fought in every war that this nation has ever had. So we don't have a foreigner mentality. But because of that, we don't think in terms of having and creating our own. So anytime white people shut us out or disrespect us or whatever, then we're left with nothing. And we got to, you know, we march and we cry and we say, oh, they discriminated against us and all that other stuff. No other group really has to do that. I mean, they'll do it when they get blatantly disrespected, but you don't see no Chinese people marching. You don't see no the Hispanic people other than the immigration stuff and the illegals marching. They have their own. You go down to Miami, Cubans run Miami. You know, you can go to any major city in America, and you got Koreans.
Can I make a point before you get too far?
Go ahead.
Okay, but the point I wanted to make is that earlier when you were saying that you see the Cubans and the Hispanics and the Vietnamese and all these people when they come in, they buy one shop. And the whole families come and work there, and other people come and they train them. Then they open another shop close to it, another shop somewhere. So eventually they're on the whole strip mall or the whole building. See, we became so Americanized, we didn't want to be inconvenienced. You know, we didn't want to be inconvenienced. So when our people came down, our relatives come down and say, no, man, I ain't got enough room for all y'all. I've seen a house where you see so many people coming out of the house, you try to figure out where everybody can sleep. But they did it because they were saving money. They were saving money, and they were building up for something, and they bought some property, and they bought this and bought another house so everybody could move in and bought another house.
Well, some of it is the fact that they actually have a population that they exploit. So the Asians who bought, and I've seen this. I've witnessed this firsthand. If you go to any gas station, you know, there's an Indian guy who owns the gas station, and then there's the immigrant workers that he has that he pays, you know, practically nothing that you know, work at the gas station. African American, we didn't have any population to exploit.
I'm just saying that we don't want to be inconvenienced by struggling through the process to make it.
You mean in terms of establishing a business?
In terms of establishing anything, establishing this household, this stronger family unit or whatever it is. We don't really want to be inconvenienced. I'm saying, you know,
I would stop at your first part. I would stop at the first point, which is we don't want to be inconvenienced in terms of establishing a business. The whole aspect of establishing a strong family, that's all based in economics. Black people always want to turn that into some spiritual or moral thing, and if that's not what it's about. Black men, there's a direct correlation between black men's unemployment and underemployment and them not getting married. Or they're not sticking around and raising their kids. They don't have the financial resources to lay any foundations in the community. That only sets up a situation where you're going to be emasculated, you know, by a woman in a household where everything she gets, including her employment, including, you know, her food stamps, housing, WIC, whatever, she's getting that from the government without, you know, a man's authority, without his input, without having to.
But at some point in time, if you're not ready, you have to stop making babies.
I agree, but I'm saying
I understand your point completely. I'm saying
let me finish. Gotta move on. Go ahead.
Of knowing that we're not ready for it.
Okay, Colin, finish that, and we gotta move on.
I was saying, right now there is no. Everything starts with the economy. Okay, you can't establish anything without an economy. You can't. I mean, even a church. God doesn't make churches. Churches are actually buildings that are constructed. You can't defend or preserve any of your culture if you don't have an economy. Because when you don't have an economy, people are in survival mode. And when people are in survival mode, morals and all that stuff, you know, cultural positive ethos break down. You're not going to have a positive male identity that's constructive, you know, towards the community, because there are no positive male positions that are being passed on from the elders to the youth to build and maintain the community. So when you don't have men building and maintaining, then you don't have any sort of female dependency, then you're going to have disrespect, you know, coming from the women, because they're not dependent on black men for their economic survival. They are dependent on white men for their economic survival. So in terms of there being a patriarchal structure like every other community that exists, it falls apart. So right now we have this quasi-matriarchal, role-reverse community where, seriously speaking, it is the men who go out there and build and maintain the integrity of the community. Now, I don't care where you go, you're not going to see, you know, black women walking around with yellow hard hats going off to build the next community center with brick and mortar. That's not how it operates. Men have to have ownership, and they have to have pride in what they create. But not only do a lot of young men not have the skills, but we can even learn from the older generation in terms of, hey, how do I go off and open up 3 gas stations? See, I can go and ask my Indian friends that, because they have fathers and uncles and everybody else who's already currently doing that. But in the black community, you know, since we were so dependent on industry, all of that has collapsed. And over the last 30 years, you have nothing but a bunch of young men, skillless men, you know, where they're told, oh, go and get an education. And then at the end of the day, what? You're dependent on getting a job from white people who don't even want to give you a job. You cannot sell a dream that you don't own. And that was the problem with the short-sightedness of the civil rights movement. We integrated, but we integrated socially, but we didn't integrate economically.
Good point, Colin. Good point. Listen, that was a mouthful. And that's a whole show, a whole nother show. Colin, I thank you so much. I thank you so much because you made some good points. And I do have to acknowledge that. Thank you so much. And you know what, yo, speaking of what he just said, and I have to agree, Tyler Perry posted something this week, and he said he gave a short speech. It wasn't even 5 minutes long, and if y'all go look for it on whatever it's out there on the internet. But he said something that speaks to what this young man just said. He said how he got to where he was. Everybody asked him what was his key to success, and he said, my key to success was I found one thing and I stuck to it. And he said, despite all the times that people discouraged me, or I did plays and nobody showed up, or I did plays and I spent my whole income tax check and only 30 people showed up, I stuck with it. I stuck with it. And I thought about what he said, and today I went into an Asian business. And it's not a big operation, but they were efficient. Their prices were reasonable, and they had a whole slew of them working in there. And it was what AJ said. They all were training each other. One was doing one thing, one was doing another thing, but it made the whole operation work. And what I realized about success, and he's right, we're not teaching each other. We're not each one teach one, passing it on to the next generation. What I realized about all those other groups, they all had one thing that they're sticking to. We're all over the page, but every other group, you got the Italian who's making the pizza and the pasta. You got the Asian who's making the Chinese food. He's got the hair beauty supply stores, and he's got the alteration shops. You know, you got the foreigners who come in from the Middle East, and they all got the market cornered on the motels. You know, we just don't have anything that we're known for. We're not doing anything consistently. And so it speaks to what the young man said. After we integrated, we didn't have a plan. So we made a little leeway, and because we didn't have a plan, we're moving backwards. Would y'all agree with that? AJ, Christopher, are y'all asleep on me? You see? Okay, y'all. I agree with it, even if they don't.
No, I'm sorry.
what I wanted to say on that is that, no, you're right, because part of the economic conundrum is ownership. For instance, if most black folks don't realize that black America spends, has an economic worth or value each year of approximately $1.3 trillion, which is like 13th or 14th on the world ranking of wealth. Now, with that being said, there is a lot of things that we could do, but I think AJ had said it earlier. The church used to be the fundamental base for a lot of the networking in the community. And unfortunately, a lot of churches, not all, but a lot of churches have fell by the wayside in terms of providing very stable information. People would share information. If I needed my car fixed, I wouldn't take it over to the white mechanic on the north side of town. I could take it to my black mechanic because worked on the pastor's car. I had a good reputation, so that kept money in the community. But the problem is, like, I think when we're talking about where we've come since the civil rights and so forth, it deals with that there's more black folks that are wearing or driving their wealth than actually having any wealth. And then that is then the backdrop to that is because we are not manufacturing hardly anything. We're consumers, but we don't make it.
But, you know, I think one of the major things that happened in our community was once the churches established themselves and got big enough, they moved out of the place that built them into what they are. And they didn't send buses back to grab the community. They moved to the suburbs and to other places and off the freeway to these giant mega churches and forgot they were a part of the community that they came from. It's like they left that community abandoned, hoping somebody else would come in that building and do what they did when what they did was their job. And I think that was a disbursement. That kind of broke things up because you grew up in this place where you thought you had these men that were talking about something. Now they made enough money. Now you got to reestablish what was going on. And like you said, I think, to me, when the family unit, your cousins move from downtown, your cousins having problems in Greenville or wherever, Denison, you say, okay, move down here, we can get a job. So you say, we're going to get a job, and we're going to make this plan, and we're going to do this. And first, you're going to stay here, we're going to get some land or get a house, and then we're going to bring some other people down. So you start accumulating this money, you have a plan. But we lost the plan. We're just individualized hustlers. That's it. Even the churches are individualized hustlers. They moved out of the community where they started. Now they're hustling in somewhere else, trying to get 30,000 members.
And AJ, you're right, because I know here in Chicago, for a fact, probably 65% of the traditional community or neighborhood-based churches have relocated, and they tend to relocate outside of Cook County. So they're in a suburb that creates a hardship for people to get there, and then, like you said, they just pull that community, that network out of the neighborhood, and it's no longer there. And so that, like my mother-in-law's church, I mean, she's probably having a lot of issues with getting back and forth. But then there's a lot of other people who are having that same problem. But it breaks up the network. It breaks up the intent of the black church, and a lot of people don't no longer have that support.
I so agree. You know, just thinking about it, and the young man made a brilliant point, and you really have to admit, we did. We went into a movement head first, without a plan. All that we wanted to do was speak to the fact that we wanted to be equal. But, you know, a lot of times what we left behind wasn't so bad. You know what I'm saying? We had strong schools in our community. We had strong businesses in our community. But our thirst to be included with our Caucasian brother, We left everything we knew behind.
Really think it was the inclusion part. What it was is we had the jobs. We had the lawn service jobs. We had those jobs. We had the building cleaning job. We have all those jobs that somebody else have now. We had those jobs, but when we actually segregated, we thought we were better than the jobs and the businesses we had. So they were showing us this other side. Like, you can go here, you can start in the mayor room, and in 15 years you can be up here as assistant manager. You know. So we left our job that we were actually hiring people and making money at, because it was a chore. It was actually manual labor. And we said, you know, we didn't want to be manual labor, and we didn't want to pick cotton. So now you want to go to these other jobs. And we left those jobs, they start saying that all these other people come and taking our jobs. But they weren't. They're taking the jobs we left. So we left those businesses down. And we all had, there was barbershops in the community, there were beauty shops, there was all kind of little shops that we had that was making money in the community, because the money was staying in the community. But when the barbershop got bigger and they saw barbershop moved to the suburbs, barbershop moved somewhere else because it was a better location, more people, right off the freeway, way away from where they originated. So now the money is no longer in the community. So we did this to ourselves.
And so now the community looks like, I don't know, a rundown hood for the most part, a lot of vacant buildings, a lot of, you know, crack houses, and we just abandoned the community, you know. So now
exactly.
The community is a hood, which is sad, but that's just where
we
are.
We took the neighbor out. We actually took the neighbor out.
Yeah, we did. We did. We left the hood.
Exactly.
And you know, and so now who's running the hood? The hoodlums, the gangsters, the cracked out drug dealers or drug dealers. That's who's running the hood. And so we in our quest to be included, left what we had to try to acquire something, you know, else. And now, you know, where are we at? I mean, we left a whole community behind that's now turned into a hood.
Because when young boys don't see any men, they think they're men.
Very true.
It used to be what a church was there. There was always men walking around. There was always men cleaning, touring the church, helping the neighborhood, passing out flyers, doing all the things that men do. So you see men, and you see how men act and how they walk and how they talk. But when the neighborhood is barren of men, all these boys become 13 and 14, so now they've heard all the time, you got to take care of your mom. You got to be the man of the house. So now he thinks he's a man because he don't see any men.
I agree.
Well, and on that, they don't see any men because the large majority of the men are in prison or in trouble or felons and can't get a job. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, the you know, there's almost 2 million men in prison, and 62% of those are black men.
And you know what, Christopher, a lot of the times when a movement begins, they know that a large group of our population is not going to show up because, you know, you can start saying, well, we're going to do this or we're going to do that, and the first thing you'll get from a large number of brothers is, I would, but I got a whole lot of tickets. You know, I can't drive my car down there because I got a whole lot of tickets, or I can't because I'm on paper.
But Carrie, it was about 15 years ago, they were doing tests in elementary schools with third graders. And by the scores of the test, they could estimate how many of the black children were being incarcerated by the age of 14 and 15.
Wow.
And that was like a survey. You know, we're doing a survey of how many prisons we need to build. So that's why they start building all these prisons and open up these prisons and commercialize the prisons, because they say, we can make money. We know how many people we're going to have.
Step before that, that's why you also had the projects, because they, I mean, they knew with the projects that after, because actually they were putting projects initially, they were putting intact black families in there. But what started to happen is then they started putting displaced single mothers, single fathers into those environments. They knew the propensity of what it would perpetuate, and that would end up being a lot of crime, a lot of killings, and so forth. So it's like what AJ is saying with you know, moving forward. But people don't understand why a lot of these things were done. They were not done to help black folks.
That's true. It's kind of like, what did they say? The NRA was started so that they could help black folks? I don't think so. But that's what they say.
Right.
I don't think so, y'all. But that's the story they feel, and they stick to it. I mean, and you're right.
Yeah,
they have
rope sales.
They
have rope sales to help black folks.
You see what I'm saying? It's you know. I'm sorry, y'all. Y'all got to wake up and read between the lines on some of this stuff when they tell you it just ain't true. If you just tuned in, you come center stage for the topic of famous black female leaders who were pivotal in the civil rights movement, and there's just so many. You know, Harriet Tubman, Fannie Lou Hamer, Sojourner Truth, Rosa Parks, Mahalia Jackson, Nikki Giovanni, Mary McLeod Bethune, Susan B. Anthony.
McLeod,
I keep calling it wrong. McLeod, I'm sorry. McLeod and Mary Ann, what was her? Mary Ann, what Curry? Mary Ann? I think that was one of yours. I'm sorry. But we're talking about all of these people that a lot of times some of you heard, some of that you haven't heard, that were really strong giants in the civil rights movement. But history, for whatever reason, has left out a lot of the females, and you only hear about during Black History Month the Frederick Douglasses and the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's and people like that, and for some reason they just don't include these women. So tonight, as you said, we're going to talk about Mary McLeod Bethune. Did I pronounce that right?
McLeod like the sky. McLeod like the sky.
McLeod, I don't know why I keep calling her wrong, y'all, but she was born July 10th, 1875 to May 18th, 1955. Now, y'all, this is another one. She, like, blew me away when I read about her because she had a certain coolness when you read her biography that was just, I don't know, it just spoke to the fact that black women have always been strong. And for whatever reason, history has not wanted to give us our credit. But she was an African American educator and a civil rights leader, best known for starting a school for African American students in Daytona Beach, Florida, that eventually became Bethune-Cookman University, and for being an advisor to President Franklin D. Roosevelt. She was known as the First Lady of the Struggle because of her commitment to bettering African Americans. Now, go figure. And this was the crazy part about what she did. Now, this is, remember, the time period in which she lived was 1875 to 1955. But the school she started for African-American girls in Daytona started with 6 students, y'all, then grew and merged with an institute for African-American boys that eventually became Bethune-Cookman School. The quality was so great that it surpassed the standards for education for African-American students and was rivaled by schools for whites. Now, go figure. I mean, that's just the kind of level of education that they were providing at this school that even the white schools were envying what they were doing over there. And Bethune, she worked for the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932 and became a member of Roosevelt's black cabinet. And what she did was she shared concerns of black people to Roosevelt's administration. And at that time, most black people were Republicans. And Roosevelt, of course, was a Democrat. And so she began to spread the message to blacks about who Roosevelt was. And also a columnist named Louis E. Martin said that she gave out faith and hope as if they were pills and she was some sort of doctor. That's just how bad she was. I mean, that's crazy because obviously what she was doing was so strong that people were able to grab a hold to the faith that they saw in her and the hope that they saw in her for a better day. That's amazing, you know, to be in that time period and be able to be so inspirational that you were giving out faith and hope like it was some kind of pill. That's what I found. She was just cool. She was just absolutely just she was one of the coolest and the smartest of all the ladies, and all of them had, you know, great strength, but I just found her just to be the coolest, and the fact that she was giving advice to the, you know, to the president, and she was starting schools that, you know, white people were envious of, and the fact that she was so great an inspiration that, you know, people considered her to be like somebody who could give out medicine for hope and faith. Loved her.
And you know what, when you have talented, intelligent, strong black women, a lot of people don't know. I often tell people that part of the women's suffrage movement and part of what directly was affected and came from black women struggling help white women. White women didn't even get the right to vote until 1921. So that kind of tells you what they white males thought of them. That means their wives, their grandmamas, their mamas, they weren't even concerned about them having the right to vote. They didn't even get that to 1921. Now, you'll see white women's suffrage, but the backdrop to that and voting rights, that's when I spoke about Fannie Lou Hamer and other individuals that were in that movement for that, black women carved out justice for white women, and a lot of white women know that, but a lot don't know that. They think they did it, but it was really the struggle of the black woman that got them. And I'll say this, Dick Gregory, he got in trouble for this, but he was talking about that very thing about the suffrage of black women gaining advances for white women, and really that was part of the pinnacle thing that got white women as well as black women the right to vote. But he said the next time you see a white woman, he didn't use those terms, he said you see a ugly, fat white woman, he said a black woman got her that job because the airline, you had to look a certain way and have a certain shape to be an airline stewardess. But black women pushing for equality was the reason that they broke those barriers down. So black women have done so many things that it created advances for white America, and a lot of white America don't even know, let alone appreciate that.
I agree with that. I absolutely, and you know, but today we see when we talk about that, we'll see when people talk about gay rights, and they'll compare gay rights to the civil rights movement. And I sometimes struggle with that because I can't decide if they're equal. Does it make sense how people will say, well, you know, black people went through this? Say what?
I don't struggle with it. It's not the same.
people compare it all the time.
Because, you know what? Because everybody, they want to use something to try and justify and validate what they're trying to do. If you're trying to do that, do it on its own merit. You cannot couple civil rights or the struggle of civil rights or what folks went through. The thing is that I think what is more appropriate to say is that if you're saying, because I am gay or lesbian, that I shouldn't be persecuted, that I should deserve to live the life that I choose, I have no issue with that. But don't take something that is a choice. I mean, me being black and me being having to deal with Jim Crow and white supremacy and all that stuff, that's not something I make a choice of. That's something I deal with every day. So most people in general, they may look at a person and say, oh, I think that person is gay. Oh, I think that person. But most of it is because of what that person chooses to tell other individuals or their conduct. So, no, I think that would be absurd to think that in any way that those two issues and or struggles could be even considered in the same arena.
And you know what? And to piggyback off what he said, or to clarify what I think he just said or how I look at it, because we're going to get in trouble on that one. I think what I'm saying is this, to be clear. Every day that I walk out of my house, it is clear that I'm African-American. And I'm considered a high yellow African-American, but I'm still African-American, and you can clearly tell that. And so when I walk out of my house, I'm automatically identified as a black woman. But if I walk out of my house and I'm a gay African-American, I think I can conceal the fact that I'm gay, but I can never conceal the fact that I'm African-American. Can we agree on that, y'all?
Yeah. Well, yes, and I'll say this real quick. But the gay community, the reason that they're trying to parallel or piggyback off of black civil rights struggle is that they say on one hand it's not a choice or it is a choice, but then on the other hand they say, well, you're born that way. So we are, in fact, similar to black folks, but you're not born that way. That's a choice, but you are born white, you are born black, you are born whatever you're born. So I think when you try to mix to justify
your further gain or your advancement that you're actually trying to get. So, I mean, it's not just about, oh, I just want to be whatever I choose. I don't want to be persecuted. It's something that has a larger agenda to it, not just I want to live this lifestyle. Please leave me alone. It has more to do with a lot of other things. And you're right. That's another show, but no, the two are not the same.
I'm going to give y'all Christopher's email on that one because I clarified my stance on it. But anyway, Christopher, I tried to help you out. But that's really how I see it, though. You can clearly conceal one and you can't conceal the other. You know, and I've had relatives in my family that were so light that they could pass, and they have, some of them. And I don't think it was verbal. I think it was just people just assumed. And so that said, that's very few of us. And so I think there's many others. We can't hide it. And so when you get through at the end of the day, I just really see it as if I was gay, I don't have to tell you. But if I'm black and you know, my skin complexion is obvious to you that I'm black, then I can't conceal it. I don't know. AJ, how do you see it?
I'm kind of like you because I think that one has 400 years of persecution behind it. But the thing is, you know, when you're looking at something to attach yourself to or something that worked, you know, you don't want to go and say, I'm fighting for this and attach something that didn't work. Since the civil rights movement kind of worked, that's the closest thing that can be said, you know, to make it look like this movement is this movement.
And I'll tell you something else. It has never been popular to be black, but it is very popular right now to be gay.
Yes,
You agree with that, y'all?
When is the last time you've heard any case where a person, a gay individual, has been pulled over, stopped and frisked because they're gay? Name me one in New York. When has any person that you know been pulled over or harassed by the police specifically? I'm not saying there's not cases, but to use that premise and to say that means that somebody has to know that is your lifestyle or your preference. You can see that me, you, AJ, that we black.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not, you know, a lot of people, they'll jump off right away and say, well, oh, you're homophobic. No. I will be the first to say nobody should be persecuted. Nobody should be discriminated against because that is a lifestyle or a way of life that they choose. I have no issue with that. And I'll be the first to stand to say that if you did that based on a person's choice, lifestyle choice, that you would be wrong. But then you cannot tell me if I say that I don't believe in that lifestyle, then you can't call my free speech hate. But I'm telling
you, what?
The
but you know what's amazing?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, finish.
No, I'm done. I want to hear you.
No, you know, and it just, a light bulb moment. I just, you never hear gay people saying or basically connecting their struggle to the Holocaust. Just saying. But you'll hear them say, you know, their struggle is very much like, you know, they don't consider their persecution anything like what the Jews went through, but they'll consider their struggle like the civil rights movement, you know. But you know, it's not the same.
Sure. It's not the same. And now let me say this quick little blurb. Listen, when I was reaching out to organizations as a war veteran. Served 20-plus years in the military when I was wrongfully arrested. The ACLU is one organization that I was a card-carrying member.
Damn.
Had been for a long time. I just simply reached out to them and said, hey, I got this situation that happened to me. This is what is going on. And you know they stopped me midstream, and do you know that they told me my type of case is not the kind of case that they would want to get involved to represent? She said, and I quote, we are dealing more with cases of homosexual discrimination, and she went on to name some other things. So I said, if I had then called you and premised to say, I'm a Army soldier that is and I'm a homosexual, and this happened, and then I went into what happened. So you're basically saying that you would have then, my case would have been more significant to you, more profound to you. So some organizations don't even want to help folks unless you have that lifestyle attached to you, because that's where money is and that's where influence is. So some organizations won't even entertain what you have to say unless it's dealing with certain things of a certain nature.
See, that's mind-boggling. That's mind-boggling. But it's happening. And you know, the thing, and I'm not a homophobic either, and I really want to make that clear, but I think what I really do see is there's an agenda. There's just an agenda by some people, and I think a lot of naive people just don't pick up on it's an agenda. It's an agenda whenever you turn on the TV, whenever you pick up an advertisement in a magazine or you know, anytime you go look at the billboards, you turn on the TV, you know, everywhere you go, church, you're bombarded with a certain message. That's an agenda by some people. I mean, that's not happenstance. That's not just happening. And so I think that just bothers me. And I don't really think, you know, it's equal to the civil rights movement, but that's just me. You know, I mean, black folks went through a whole lot to get to this point, and I don't think that I see gay people as having gone through that same struggle. That's just my point. And I'm going to move on for that, because that's a whole nother show. That's just a whole nother show. But there was a lot of famous black women. Do you want to speak on any others? A.J., Mahalia Jackson, Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah, I want to talk about Lena McGirl.
Nope.
Yeah, because Lena Horne, she was, man, Lena was awesome, man. I'm trying to tell you, Lena was so bad.
Beautiful.
Because Lena Horne, you know, Lena Horne, she was probably one of the first black women that could walk through the front of any of the clubs and perform, because all the other blacks had to go through the back.
Mm.
And she had a lot of stuff going on, and everything was good up until they saw what, you know, they saw her political affiliations, and she was, and she was an activist with voting rights, and then they blacklisted her from Hollywood. So she couldn't get no work in Hollywood. So she went back to doing, you know, the club thing, and she actually she worked with Eleanor Roosevelt to pass the anti-lynching laws. And she met with John F. Kennedy in the White House 2 days before he was assassinated, and met with Medgar Evers the weekend before Evers was assassinated.
Whoa.
Something. So she was out in it, but it was all these other things going on, so her name went in. She was actually one of the people that funded everything that Martin was doing. Her money was going to it, so it wasn't that she was just an activist. She was putting money where her mouth was, where her feet were. And I just thought that was so awesome that, you know, all these things that you don't know about this person that sung Stormy Weather and the other songs that she sung, you know. But it was just amazing that this beautiful black woman couldn't get a job in Hollywood because of her affiliation. And it didn't matter what she looked like. It mattered who she walked like.
Hmm. You know, y'all, we want to close out tonight's show with solutions. Do we have any solutions how we can get back on track? I mean, you know, because, you know, I really feel like we're losing a whole generation because they don't have anybody to look up to. You know, when I came along, I could, you know, call out a whole list of people that I could say when I grow up I want to be like. But I don't think we have a whole lot of those that this generation is looking up and saying, I want to be like. I mean, they're talking about athletes and rappers and, you know, R&B singers, you know, as idols, because they don't have any strong leaders to look up to.
Well, me, I think the first step in the solution is, you know, I do a lot of creating writing workshops, and I do mentoring. But like, I think the problem is that they're not confident in this education system. So, you know, I tell my sons and everybody else, add 3 words to your vocabulary a day. See, a lot of times when you can talk to people on the level that they're talking, you feel better about your conversation. Then you feel better about yourself because you actually communicate with everybody. Then you feel better about listening because you understand what everybody's saying. So I think we have to start in the minute process of understanding that we need to better our ability to communicate. So that way we will better our ability to understand. And then we can go from there as far as, but I think you need the mentors in the community so they could see what a black man looked like, what he walked like, what he sounded like, how he act. You know, because when you don't have anything to go by, you start thinking you are the ish. You know, something like that. You are the ish, you know. But and the thing is, you have all these, like I said, you have 15, 16-year-olds that are in single-family households that would swear to your man.
Yeah. Because you know what? And then we're so bad about it in our community, saying that's the little man of the house. You know, he'll be 2 years old, and they'll be starting off saying he's the little man of the house. So by the time he's 12, he think he is the man of the house because ain't no other man around. And so you're right. They don't have anybody to look up to, and there's no other male role models, you know, around. So they are assuming roles way too early and, you know, based on no experience, based on nothing. They the little man of the community, and it's scary. It's absolutely scary. And so I have to agree. Christopher, you got any solutions on how we can put this train back on the track?
Well, I do know that having local chapters of good grassroots organizations are good, and actually trying to get individuals involved in those and letting them know that these type of organizations do exist. I think part of the problem is that after Malcolm X and Dr. King, a lot of people that may have continued on if there was a strong leader or leaders present would have. But I think the churches is going to be can be one of the return to mainstays and pinnacle starting points for the black community. And then I think, too, getting back with the grassroots organizations coupled with those churches, a lot of things can happen. I mean, a lot of people are buying memberships with PUSH, National Action Network, NAACP, and that's all fine and good. But in terms of the mechanism that we need socioeconomically, honestly, I believe that a lot of the black so-called civil rights organizations and leaders, they're out for themselves. They're not really down for the cause because they're worth too many millions to be down for the cause. So it's a lot of lip service and a lot of less doing. But I think the grassroots organizations and the church coupled with that can be a way for us to make our climb back.
I think you're right. I think if there's an answer, I think it would begin with the fact that everybody's got to do something. And I think in this generation, everybody is looking for somebody else to be the leader. When we all can do something, and we all have gifts, and I think we all need to operate in our gifts and then bring those gifts to the table, because there is a movement. You know, it's just, it may be small, but there's always a movement somewhere. And I'd say get with a positive group that's moving forward and doing something in the community and be a part of that, because I think unity is so needed. And I think people need to stop with the, you know, not wanting to follow anybody. Everybody wants to be the leader. Everybody is not designed to be a leader. There's going to be chiefs and there's going to be Indians. And I think what happened after Dr. King and Malcolm died is everybody wanted to either be the head or they didn't want to be anything at all. So everybody just, you know, dispersed and went their own ways, and nothing has happened. And no one has stood up and just said, well, you know what, let's start here. We need to start at ground zero again with an organization where, you know, we come together and we realize that our community is in trouble, and we start brainstorming on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis of trying to figure out how to repair it. I think that's got to happen. I mean, because our community is in shambles. I mean, when you go into a hood, you know you just went into a hood, you know, by the way it looks. And it just looks like a group of or a people that have lost all hope. How do we lose hope in 50 years? How do we lose all hope? When you go into the community, the people look like they just given up. Or go into the hood, everybody looks like they just given up. You know, a lot of them are on crack. You know, a lot of them are, you know, poverty stricken. It's just, it's like a feeling of hopelessness, you know. I went to New Orleans several years ago, and I got that feeling. You know, when I was in the airport area, y'all, I felt one way. But by the time we got closer and closer into the city, I began to see poverty just on the faces of the people without ever knowing them. And then the more and more you got a feel for the city over the couple of days that I was there, it was just a feeling of just hopelessness. How did we become so hopeless in 50 years when we're supposed to have more than we've ever had?
Well, it goes back to last hired, first fired. It's like I was telling you, we gave up all our businesses to join corporate jobs because corporate jobs were blooming. They were booming and all over the place. And you could go and get training on the job, and they would pay you to go to school, get some training. So you were in a shirt and tie to work, not sweating like you were when you was doing the yards or building houses or whatever. So when this downsizing came, when corporates start downsizing, you start letting corporations buy other corporations and become conglomerates. The last hire first fired, and that was us. Mm-hmm. So we lost these jobs that we thought we'd have for forever and get the little gold watch. So now you were back to, you know, some menial job or not really willing to accept or go back to do what you were doing at first because you think you're better than that. And I think we've all gotten to a place where we think we're better than what we have, what's out there. And we're not willing to sacrifice and build our own.
You know, I guess you're right. I mean, because, you know, in 50 years, we're more physically sick, we're more mentally sick, and financially we're just strapped. I mean, and we thought, and we're acting like we're doing better now than we were then, but in many ways it looks like we were better off then than we are now as a community.
Well, because the more we made, the more we got.
We got what?
The more we made, the more we spent, the more we got. Because when you have all these things, you say, okay, I don't drive to beat up car no more. I got a brand new car. But you know, you're looking at the insurance, you're looking at the payments, and it looks good to ride in, but you got to go to work these 60 hours to make sure you have enough money to pay for it.
Yeah. And, you know, and y'all, I'm going to talk about a personal example I know, and I'm talking about this to somebody I know, and they may hear this show, y'all, and if they do, well, this is how I really feel. But I know somebody who personally works 7 days a week. They have an $80,000 car and a $160,000 house, and they have to work 7 days a week to pay for it. And in my mind, that ain't living. That's just me. That ain't living. And I thought, well, why would I want to work 7 days to be stressed out to pay for bills that, you know, I mean, that just doesn't make sense. I mean, I would rather have less, you know, I mean, because you got an $80,000 car that you can't even get around to driving because you work 7 days a week. But anyway,
well,
so
they bought into driving their wealth. And the other thing to that, it may be an $80,000 car, but by the time they do, if they ever are successful in paying for it, it's going to cost them way more than $80,000. So the investment is not worth the return.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and so I think we're going backwards. You know, I mean, we're spending more than we have. You know what I'm saying? We're just over indebted, which is stressing us out. And physically, they're stressing us out. Mentally, it's stressing us out. And we're going backwards. I mean, we as a community have not made the strides that we should have in 50 years for whatever reason. We're just stagnated. And I just think we just got to get back to the grassroots where they used to meet back in the day and they used to brainstorm on how to get to the next level. And I think this time, if we're successful in getting to the next level, we need to have a plan of what we're going to do when we get there and how we're going to maintain and move forward from there as opposed to, I think we've went backwards a little bit. I think
we're just waiting on everybody else to move. We said, okay, I'm waiting on you. So we went there by the moving, nobody's moving.
Sad but true.
So you're looking at me and I'm looking at you. It ain't nobody moving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Waiting on everybody to move and nobody's moving, so we're just waiting.
And tomorrow come and go and we're doing the same thing.
We're doing the same. And, you know, I mean, this is year after year after year. And, y'all, listen, and you know, Christopher is always hard on Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton. But in reality, them the only two that's out there. I mean, it's amazing out of how many black people they say it is in the world. And, I mean, we make up 12% of the population. And out of 12% of the population, 13% of the population, only two people step up. That's crazy.
But Karen, we can only move during the week. Because everybody got a part on the weekend.
No, we got to look beyond what people have looked at as their traditional leaders to lead them forward. And other people are going to have to step up, or if you're not a leader, at least get with somebody who's trying to do something positive. And like you said, do what you can do at your level in your community, neighborhood that you live at, because at least that will be something. Because if you're not doing anything, you're not going to make any kind of progress forward. And then the grassroots organization, at least, I mean, like with grassroots underground radio and TV and so forth, a lot of information, if it were not for shows like yours and others, that information wouldn't even get put out. And people would just be satisfied with traditional mainstream, white mainstream media, and they may not know that other things exist besides Sharpton and Jesse and NAACP. I'm not saying don't work with those organizations. I'm saying that what's been going on for the last 5, 10, 20, 30 years, it's not getting any better with those organizations in the forefront. So people are going to have to do something different at a smaller level to get something done.
Well, y'all listen, I just had a brainstorm. Maybe AJ, Christopher, and I are going to start something. Listen, don't y'all tear us down. Get with us.
Okay, one last note. Last note is, if you are the smartest person in your circle, you need to you have to draw a bigger circle.
See, that's why I got AJ and Christopher in my circle, because I ain't the smartest person. Let me stop. Y'all, let's go ahead. Listen, hold up now. Well, y'all, listen, that's going to have to be the final word. I'd like to say, Christopher and AJ, I enjoy tonight. I think we let it be known that there were some females that were part of the movement, and they had they've done a lot to move us forward. And we just wanted to highlight that tonight, and I think we did a good job of that. Also, listen, next week, y'all, will be the 21st. Come back and join us right here, Center Stage, from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern, as we do what we do each and every Friday night. If you have a show idea that you'd like to see us do, send us an email at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. That's centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Tell us what you'd like to see us do, and we'll at least consider it. We can't say that we're going to do all kinds of shows, but there's always, I guess, just to say, room for us to consider new ideas. So please send us your ideas at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Also, send us a line. Tell us what you think of us, what you think you like about the show or what you don't like about the show. It's all fine. Just send us an email. Okay, y'all, we got to get out of here. Until next week, bye-bye.